Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Muscle, the Gripping Story of Strength and Movement by Roy A. Meals, M.D. Read by Jonathan Yen. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Warm-up. Did you just blink? Was it voluntary or involuntary? Either way, one set of tiny motors closed your eyelids, and another set opened them. As you listen to these words, the muscles in the iris of your eye are automatically moving to adjust the amount of light they let in, and those around your lens are focusing the words on your retina. These are examples of movement, one of life's essential features. Sages as far back as Aristotle have tried, and failed, to come up with a universally acceptable definition of life. As a reasonable approximation, biology teachers resort to the mnemonic Mrs. Gren, which represents movement, reproduction, sensitivity, growth, respiration, excretion, and nutrition. These are the tightly interconnected index functions performed by all life forms. Among the seven attributes, movement plays double duty for animals, including humans. Not only is muscle movement critical to our internal workings of respiration, digestion, and reproduction, it can also transport us in search for the best air, food, and mate, as well as remove us from danger. This gives us a leg up on plants. To appreciate our bodies, improve our health, and move artfully at all ages, an understanding of this rippling tissue and its myriad powers is paramount. While it is possible for you to rest your eye muscles all night, another muscle never stops. Your heart has been contracting roughly 70 to 100 times a minute since you were a 3-week-old embryo. Cardiac muscle is amazingly durable and has the potential to sustain a human for over 100 years. Also working behind the scenes and out of our conscious control are the smooth muscles that cause us to blush, have goosebumps, and digest food. A third kind of muscle firmly attaches its ends to bones and can produce incredible feats of movement and strength. These skeletal muscles have enabled one man to complete 68 pull-ups in a minute, another to high jump over 8 feet, and a woman to bicycle at a record speed of 184 miles per hour. Additionally, muscles allow for communication via facial expressions, hand gestures, and vocalization. In fact, your brain has no way of conveying its thoughts without contracting some muscles. Unless, of course, you practice telepathy or subject yourself to an electroencephalogram or functional MRI. Whether keeping your blood flowing or propelling your legs when you go for a jog, muscle is the moving force behind our body's essential day-to-day functions. Muscles stand apart not only for what they can do, but also because, unlike so many of our body's internal elements, they can be observed. Only thinly draped with skin, muscles telegraph to an observer the person's overall health and vigor. The liver, kidneys, and other internal organs are just as vital as muscle, but unless they are way out of kilter, their states of health are not apparent from across the room. What's more, only muscle is amenable to spot training. With heavy lifting, you can develop bulging biceps, but heavy thinking won't enlarge your brain. And although heavy drinking will enlarge your liver, it will be your whole liver, not just part of it, and detrimentally so. Regardless of your habits, are you happy with your weight, strength, physique, blood pressure, blood sugar level, mental and physical endurance, sleep pattern? Particularly if you are sedentary for most of the day, you likely have to answer no to at least one of these questions. Furthermore, do you want a long and active life? If so, healthy muscles are key. Our muscle mass peaks at about age 27, and thereafter begins a long and inexorable decline, which, with good lifestyle choices, we can slow. Still, along the way, we may face a variety of maladies, including hypertension, myocardial infarction, gastric reflux, stress incontinence, or erectile dysfunction. All these problems stem from some muscle disorder, and a thorough understanding of how these derangements occur and can be treated guides informed lifestyle and treatment choices. Such understanding will have growing importance in future years as today's cutting-edge, emerging, and imagined technologies evolve and mature. These include perfecting artificial hearts, editing genes to cure muscular dystrophy, and advancing immunology understanding that will make pig-to-human heart transplants feasible. Maladies aside, expected increases in life expectancy and leisure time will afford us the opportunity to enjoy our muscles wisely for longer. Yet, new health and wellness myths will arise, which in finality will not stand up to scientific scrutiny. There are also current misconceptions that die hard. My parents forbade me to go swimming for an hour after eating, supposedly to avoid muscle cramps that could lead to drowning. That warning, perhaps arising from a 1908 Boy Scout manual, has been thoroughly debunked. Both the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Red Cross say it is fine to plunge right in after eating. True, digestion draws circulation away from exercising muscles, which might cause a cramp, but not to a life-threatening extent. More critically, diet supplements, exercise equipment, and gym memberships come with enticing claims for building muscle and losing fat, but how many of them are phony, and which are scientifically based, life-maintaining and life-enhancing advances that we should embrace? Answers to all these questions require an understanding of strength and movement. Muscle, the gripping story of strength and movement, is a guided tour through this force producer's myriad virtues and capabilities. Ranging between the disparate worlds of biology, art history, popular culture and bodybuilding, as well as the frontiers of gene editing and stem cell research, you will come to understand and marvel at muscle structure and function, and be in position to understand new developments. We need, for example, to find a way for astronauts to maintain muscle mass during a zero-gravity trip to Mars. And is it true that the act of smiling can make you happier? Muscle comes from the Latin word mus, meaning mouse, and was so named because it resembled a house mouse, Latin mus musculus, wiggling under the skin. These days, some men and women seek out not mice, but silicone implants to enhance their physiques. Nothing new here, because humans' infatuation with muscles spans millennia. Depicted in bronze and marble, ancient Grecian sculptures of Zeus, Atlas, Heracles, and fellow immortals are exceedingly buff, although it is unlikely that their sculptors had any direct knowledge of muscle anatomy. That changed in the Renaissance, and it shows. Michelangelo's muscular and lifelike David is a stunning tribute to the sculptor's genius and to Michelangelo's clandestine cadaver dissections. More recently, icons of pop culture, imagined and real, include Popeye, Superman, the Jolly Green Giant, Charles Atlas, and Steve Reeves, all with ripped physiques. All those who want to enhance their own musculature to emulate Marvel movie stars and those of us who just wish to maintain health and well-being without getting swole must first understand how our muscles work. Let's get moving. Chapter 1. Discovery and Description. Anatomy is the oldest medical science, and every first-year medical student continues the tradition via indoctrination in the gross anatomy lab. But gross anatomy is not repulsive. Gross, in this context, differentiates visible to the unaided human eye anatomy from microscopic study. A quick look across time will be revealing. Sushruta, India's equivalent to Hippocrates, but about 400 years earlier, wrote that every medical student should dissect a human body. The prevailing attitude, however, was that bodies of the recently deceased were sacrosanct and should be touched only in preparation for burial. Sushruta advised a workaround for inquisitive medical students. Place the corpse in a wicker basket and submerge it in a slowly moving stream. Some days later, briskly whisk-broom the decomposing body without touching it to reveal its anatomical secrets. That undoubtedly was gross, and the process did not reveal and preserve any useful knowledge of muscle anatomy. Neither did the practices in ancient China and Egypt. Confucius dominated intellectual life in China for centuries, and reasoning and assumption prevailed over observation, which would have meant dissection. In ancient Egypt, perhaps 70 million bodies were eviscerated and embalmed, and certainly could have provided ample material for methodical dissection and advanced understanding. However, a special class of priests, rather than doctors, prepared the dead for burial and removed the internal organs piecemeal through small openings, again missing an awesome opportunity to study anatomy and pathology. Galen's pervasive influence. It was the same in ancient Greece as it was in China and Egypt. Knowledge was based on logic and speculation. Reasoning superseded observation. The advent of observational anatomy took place across the Mediterranean in Alexandria, where in about 250 BCE, Herophilus and Erasistratus likely performed the first systematic human dissection. Observational science, however, did not catch on in the Roman Empire, where the Greek tenets regarding knowledge and learning prevailed. Then, about 150 CE, along came Galen, a Greek doctor living in Rome. In addition to being physician to emperors and surgeon to gladiators, he was a prolific medical writer, the most influential of all time. Unfortunately, regarding human anatomy, he was often wrong. This stemmed from his minimal first-hand observations of human anatomy, which were limited to gladiator wounds and the occasional corpse that washed up on shore. Galen compensated for this by dissecting monkeys, pigs, and bears. He assumed, erroneously, that human anatomy was identical to that seen in his dissections. More than 1,000 years later, physicians and anatomists still held Galen's writings in the highest esteem, and when they encountered a discrepancy between Galen's truth and their own lying eyes, they sided with Galen. For instance, they rationalized that the anatomy they were observing had apparently changed since Galen's time, and that the curved thigh bone described by Galen had straightened over the centuries by the habit of wearing cylindrical nether garments. Medieval anatomists also reasoned, when they found fewer segments constituting the breastbone than Galen had recorded, that the robust chests of ancient heroes might well have had more bones than current-day degenerates could claim. It should not be surprising, then, that anatomical drawings of the time were crude sketches at best, if not entire fantasies. To the credit of the pre-Renaissance anatomists and physicians, however, there was no great need to understand anatomy, especially musculoskeletal anatomy, because bloodletting and amputations were the only limb surgeries performed. Anatomy and art. Anatomy, like so many fields of study, changed with the coming of the Renaissance. Artists and anatomists became more interested in understanding and depicting the human body, including its internal structures. In the 1470s, Antonio del Pollo Juolo, who is known along with his artist brother to have dissected corpses, painted the Battle of the Nudes. It reveals a remarkable understanding of straining muscles and has been described as a rhetoric of anatomical display that would last for centuries. 30 years later, the German painter Albrecht Dürer, among others, reinforced the melding of art and anatomy when he began portraying realistic nude bodies under the guise of telling Christian stories to avoid religious sanctions. The intertwining of the two disciplines came to full flower during the Renaissance, and especially through the contributions of Andreas Vesalius, 1514 to 1564. He was a quick study. On the day he graduated from medical school, not quite 23 years old, he accepted the offer to become the chair of anatomy and surgery at the University of Padua. 6 years later, he published the seminal De Humani Corporis Fabrica Libri Septem, on the structure of the human body in 7 books. After 1,400 years, finally, somebody had the confidence and gall to refute Galen. Inspection and measurement finally superseded reasoning and speculation, and Vesalius's book heralded the beginning of modern observational science and research. No longer would reasoning usurp observation. Most of the observations, however, were clandestine, because the Catholic Church strongly prohibited human dissection. The exception was executed criminals. Medieval medical schools were allowed 1 dissection per year, which was performed publicly, apparently to deter would-be criminals. Even almost 300 years later, the cursed sentence for an assassin remained that you be taken from hence to a place of execution where you shall be hanged by the neck until you be dead, your body to be dissected and anatomized. Once Vesalius had dissected a cadaver, he posed it in a lifelike position. In Fabrica, sequential plates depict muscles folded back layer by layer to reveal their relationships to one another. Vesalius identified muscles mostly by numbers. For instance, muscle raising the arm, the second of those that move it, and first muscle moving the foot. Later, others named these the deltoid and gastrocnemius, calf muscle, respectively. Vesalius did, however, give names to some muscles that persist today, including rectus abdominis, the muscles used for sit-ups, as well as masseter and temporalis, both for chewing. Vesalius was the premier Renaissance anatomist and depicted his dissections with an artist's flair. Vesalius and Michelangelo, 1475 to 1564, died in the same year. Did they know each other and share ideas? I don't know, but it is obvious that Michelangelo, in both paint and marble, portrayed his subjects with an anatomist's accuracy. Although he took inspiration from the ancient Greek and Roman statuary that still existed in Italy during his time, he initially felt constrained. He lamented the Catholic Church's strict edict against human dissection. Michelangelo knew that he could never portray the human body realistically without knowing its interior structure. Fortunately for the world's cultural benefit, he did dissect, on the sly. Read the memorable details in Irving Stone's biography of Michelangelo, The Agony and the Ecstasy. The two disciplines of art and anatomy truly melded under the pen of Leonardo da Vinci, 1452-1519. Among his seemingly myriad pursuits, perhaps human anatomy piqued his interest more than any other subject. He said that he dissected more than 30 cadavers over his lifetime. His drawings, sketches, and accompanying descriptions show his deep understanding of the human musculoskeletal system in motion, which was an entirely novel approach. His studies, however, were not published until after his death, and some were lost until the 19th century, so his influence on later Renaissance anatomists and artists was blunted. On discovery, however, one further aspect of Leonardo's genius became evident. He understood the muscles' attachments to bone, particularly around the shoulder, and the lever actions so created. He appreciated that a muscle's function varied according to the starting position of the joint or joints it controlled, the anatomy of movement. Leonardo also dabbled with cross-sectional musculoskeletal anatomy, a mode of representation that would not become clinically useful until the invention of computed tomography and magnetic resonance imaging nearly 500 years later. Renaissance artists not only developed and capitalized on the techniques of perspective and shading, they moved away from portraying just religious figures. If not performing dissections on their own, the artists enhanced their understanding of human anatomy by attending the once-a-year public dissections of executed criminals allowed by the church. As happened repeatedly in Galen's writings, errors in anatomical descriptions and depictions continued to occur. A famous one appears in Rembrandt's Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Tulp, painted in 1632. The forearm muscles responsible for closing the fist are seen to be attached on the outside of the elbow, whereas in fact those muscles attach on the side of the elbow closest to the trunk when the arm is at the side. True, this detail does not diminish the painting's impact, except maybe for hand surgeons, but it is a curiosity that possibly arose from Rembrandt first sketching the anatomy of a right forearm and then not correctly reversing the muscle's orientation in the final painting. Depiction in three dimensions. Despite the great advances encountered during the Renaissance in understanding anatomy and depicting the findings artistically, problems persisted in trying to depict real-world three-dimensional anatomy in two-dimensional paintings and drawings. To an extent, this was circumvented in the 18th and 19th centuries when European medical students used full-scale wax and papier-mâché models to study human anatomy. This method did not sustain interest, but another one did, and today continues to grow in importance. Russian Nikolai Pirogov, 1810-1881, likely did not know of Leonardo's cross-sectional sketches when he embarked on making his cross-sectional anatomy atlas, an illustrated topographic anatomy of saw cuts made in three dimensions across the frozen human body, which he published in 1855. 9 years before, while visiting a butcher's shop in the dead of winter, Pirogov noted that frozen pig carcasses sawed straight across demonstrated the precise positions of anatomical elements with respect to one another, whereas conventional dissections necessarily disturb the locations of superficial structures to view deeper structures, and thereby destroyed their special relationships. Pirogov realized that he could use the cold Russian winters to freeze human cadavers to the density of the thickest wood, and then saw them into slices, sometimes as thin as 1/16 of an inch, thaw them, and accurately draw the anatomical structures with their spatial relationships to one another fully preserved. Like Leonardo, Pirogoff recognized the medical value of such cross-sections over 100 years before computed tomography and magnetic resonance imaging came along, whose raw images are entirely cross-sections. In the 1990s, the National Library of Medicine extended the work of Da Vinci and Pirogoff by freezing a man's body, and later a woman's body, in huge blocks of ice. The anatomists then ground away the blocks 1 millimeter, 1/25th of an inch, at a time, from head to toe for the man, and at 3 times closer intervals for the woman. At each interval, they momentarily thawed the block's surface and photographed the anatomy. For the man, who had been slightly over 6 feet tall in life, this resulted in nearly 1,900 images, which make for a stunning head-to-toe tour of human anatomy when viewed in the time-lapse cine. The anatomists also manipulated the digital representations in the computer to produce accurate images in both the front-to-back and side-to-side planes. The body donor for the visible human male was a murderer in life, so, apropos of medieval and Renaissance times, his body was thoroughly anatomized. Other donors have had their bodies plastinated and then taken on world tours. Plastination had its start in the 1970s. A German anatomist, Gunther von Hagens, invented the technique for removing water and fat from fresh cadavers by vacuum, and then replacing these materials with curable polymers, which left the skinless tissues firm to the touch and odor-free. Von Hagens then molded the bodies into lifelike poses, some mimicking Vesalius's figures, others in full action poses, including an equestrian, with her horse, also plastinated, in full stride, and an athlete at the moment of javelin release. Whether or not you have previously considered anatomy gross, these traveling exhibits in natural history and science museums celebrate anatomy in a way that non-medical people seem to find interesting. When I have attended, other visitors from age 6 on up have expressed nothing but awe and respect for the incredible displays of skeletal musculature seemingly at work. Anyone who attends one of these exhibits is likely to be impressed and enlightened. Muscles monikers. While interest in and knowledge of anatomy increased steadily during the Renaissance, differentiating and naming the newly observed muscles proceeded with fits and starts. Vesalius tended to number them. In addition to naming 2 jaw muscles and the six-pack, he also named an arm muscle, the anterior cubitum flectentium musculus, though it seems in this case a nice succinct number would have been more user-friendly. Had all the muscles retained numbers, however, it could get cumbersome if somebody asked you to flex your number 489 and you couldn't remember which one it was, out of the roughly 650 that humans have. Fortunately, anatomists after Vesalius pitched in and gave the muscles descriptive names and renamed the anterior cubitum flectentium musculus the biceps. That's part of the good news. The bad news is that because Latin was the language of science at the time, some of the names may seem foreign to those of us whose Latin skills are languishing. The other part of the good news is that with a uniform Latin terminology, anatomists and healthcare providers around the world could, and continue to, communicate clearly with one another. And with a bit of linguistic dissection, the names are not all that foreign. Some of the original names are outright poetic. Consider, for instance, the contributions of Jan Jesenius, 1566 to 1621, a Bohemian physician, politician, and philosopher. He named the muscles controlling the eyeballs movement amatorius, muscle of lovers, superbus, proud muscle, bibitorius, muscle of drinkers.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?